Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Sanjay Torre, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Sanjay, you know, I like to kick off the show by asking what you did this weekend. It is so important to me to live vicariously through your millennial life. Tell me,
a really good weekend.
What happened? I know you had a trip.
Yes.
And you saw?
All of my friends from college. I went to a bunch of college graduations in Boston, so that was really awesome, especially. So
were they good graduations?
Really
or
good.
You fell asleep and you were like looking at your watch?
My alma mater, so like they were all students that I knew, so it was really interesting.
So you were invested?
Very invested, and a lot of professors that I knew.
So. How were the speakers? I know you like to watch the speakers.
The speakers were really good, but there weren't any like...
standout?
Yeah. They were just like mayors.
Oh, so boring.
Boring. But it was cool.
So you had a good time with your friends?
Yes, I did. It was a really good weekend. Good to catch up.
Let's see.
Coming into the station.
So we're going to have to manage this a little bit. All right. So first up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Dr. Cherie Gallant.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
And Dr. Cherie, you are with Workplace Wellness?
Yes, that's
Tell
correct.
Us a little bit about that.
So Workplace Wellness provides on-site wellness programs, including chiropractic care and ergonomic training in the workplace to help employers increase productivity 10 times, reduce costs, and increase profits by double digits.
So now how did you get into this line of work?
So I've been a chiropractor now for about 6 years, and a large portion of that has been doing workers' comp and personal injury. And I just got tired of seeing people broke down, busted, and disgusted because, one, they didn't have access to the care, or two, it wasn't readily available. And three, for regular working people, we're all at work all the time. And so you have to sacrifice time at work, or you have to sacrifice time with family and friends. And so it makes way more sense to make that healthcare and other wellness services readily available in the workplace. So that way, one, they're readily available. Two, the participation rates go up. And two, for the employer or business owner, your costs go way down and your profits go way up.
So now, when you got into the kind of, I guess you pivoted a little bit to focus primarily on corporate wellness?
Yes. So I'm actually opening a physical office tomorrow in Cobb. But yeah, the pivot is primarily towards that corporate model because, again, for me, it makes the most sense. And I think to most people, if they had the choice of accessing healthcare, would you rather a 5-10 minute visit while you're at work on your 15-minute break? Or would you rather, you know, slog through Atlanta traffic and take half a day off of work, plus maybe miss your kid's soccer game or what have you.
So now your offices are going to be actually in the office of the business you serve?
So my home base is going to be actually in shared space over in Cobb, so 2430 Herodian Way, Suite 57. But then once I contract with a client, then I actually physically go into their workplace and provide the services that they choose.
Like so many days a week, or you're there every Mondays or something?
Exactly. Yeah. It just depends on what the employer wants, or, you know, what their needs are. I mean, if they want me to come in and provide ergonomic training, you know, that might be once a week or, you know, twice a month, or regular chiropractic care, that would probably be more of a once a week thing, depending on how many employees they had. So it's just really about assessing what that particular business needs and taking a look at where they're losing all the money, and then custom tailoring that wellness program to suit their needs.
And then, so now does that affect how you market? Because now, like if you were marketing to individuals, that now you're going after business owners, you have to talk to HR people. Like how does that part of your business work?
Yeah. So HR people, safety managers, you know, anyone who's in charge of day-to-day operations, and also CFOs, CEOs, anyone who's handling the money or handling the people and, you know, the claims and see it up close and personal every day.
And then have you kind of beta tested this at corporations right now, or is this conceptual at this point?
So I have beta tested it. One small corporation, they had about 10 employees and it worked really well. We did it on a trial basis. So it was for about 4 months, and the employees really enjoyed it. And so now it's just about, you know, getting into bigger, bigger corporations. That way I can affect as many people as humanly possible and really improve their lives.
And then, so what are the elements of an effective corporate wellness program?
So one, the corporate wellness program actually has to work, meaning, first of all, you have to assess, what are you trying to achieve through a wellness program? I mean, most people and most businesses, yeah, they want people to get better, but two, the main reason is they want to decrease costs. So most programs available now are mostly blood pressure screenings, cholesterol checks, but there's no follow-up, and nor is there any plan in place to actually reduce them. And most companies don't have a real injury prevention program in place. So when I go into these companies, you know, it's, all right, well, what kind of injuries do you have? Is it more repetitive stress injuries like carpal tunnel syndrome? So, you know, more of an office facility? Or are you a manufacturing company and you have disc herniations or you have slips, trips, and falls? You know, what exactly are your needs? So for the manufacturing company, it might be more getting their joints moving better so that way they're more limber and more mobile. So chiropractic and stretching versus an office space might be better for a regular stretching program. You might provide something as simple as a daily stretching video, or, you know, you might do a weekly stretching video and then they just follow it every day. It just depends on the corporate workspace and what their needs are. And again, like, no solution fits all. And so that's where I come in, and I really take assessment of what your business needs. And then in the short term, it saves you money on those costs up front. But then long term, your employees are healthier, your employees are happier, and, you know, your long term costs go way down. There's been several companies now. There's Anheuser-Busch distributor up in Michigan. They brought in a chiropractor once a week for a year. Their work comp costs decreased by 88%. So, I mean, it speaks for itself. And even if you're an employer and you're not super invested in how happy your employees are, if you just want to think about it from a financial standpoint, it only benefits your bottom line.
But, I mean, in some ways, you're like looking at this as a math problem, right? This is going to solve a math problem for the business.
Mm-hmm. It's a math problem in part, but it's also solving a human problem. And I'm sure Chris will talk about this later. But the human problem is that people don't feel appreciated, or, you know, they don't feel like there's a really good reason why they should stay at that company. Putting these programs into a place, make them feel appreciated, but also, you know, give them that flexibility where they can access that care at work. And then they're far more satisfied, because then they don't have to take, you know, PTO or vacation days or sick days or sacrifice time with family and friends. And then the math problem is more so for the business owner and, you know, the HR people who are in charge of the numbers, and that greatly increases the long-term viability of that company. And so it's a math problem for the company. It's a human problem. The human element is more for the employees. But when you combine them together, you know, they just kind of snowball into one another. Employees are happier, so they stay longer. Employer makes more money, and so they're able to continue to employ those same people for longer and employ more people.
Now, when you're out there looking for the people, do you have to have kind of the profile of a company that has a heart that believes that this is good for, you know, the long term?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that in part, it makes it easier if the company, and I think for the most part, most companies are actually invested, at least in part, in the happiness and long term, happiness and health of their employees. So yeah, I mean, definitely having a company with a heart is a big part of it. But like I said, even if you're not so inclined towards altruism, you definitely look at it just from a number standpoint. It's a win for your employees, but it's also a win for you as the business owner.
So now, what's the biggest challenge of getting this message out to companies to invest in something like this for them,
right,
and their employees?
So I mentioned before, a lot of companies have these so-called wellness programs, but like I said, they're not very cost-effective. People, you know, some companies throw millions of dollars on blood pressure screenings and cholesterol checks, but they're not really doing anything, one, to decrease costs, or two, improve the long-term health of their employees. And so one of the biggest obstacles I've run into is, you know, approaching companies and they say, well, we already have a wellness program in place.
Right.
So then it's kind of, you have to come up with some creative, creative phrases, or, you know, just really getting in there and letting them know how different you are and why they should hire you versus just staying with the status quo.
Now, is there any kind of low-hanging fruit or a point of entry that allows you to come in at least to for you to have the beginnings of a conversation to educate them?
So, I mean, definitely, I mean, networking has been one point of entry. And then also I've started doing some, you know, talks in the community. So that's...
Have you written a book? That's what a lot of people do nowadays.
No, I have not written a book, but after today, I think that's next on my list. That's definitely next on my list. But yeah, no point of entry is definitely always interesting. And then I've also tried to be really active as of late on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important aspect to it as well. But also because I'm going after those business owners or, you know, those people who are dealing with injuries and costs, it's also approaching it from a workers' comp standpoint. Because again, businesses, you may have on your balance sheet, it might look really good, but if you're bleeding out the back end from all these different costs, over long term, it's not going to be sustainable. Because I mean, one claim could for a low back could be as much as $40,000 to $80,000 over the course of a year. So that means you have to increase your sales by $1 to $1.5 million that year to offset that cost while maintaining 3% profit margin. So if you can even decrease that by half, why wouldn't you?
So then a prospect would be somebody whose workman's comp is getting kind of out of control?
Yes. So anyone who has a lot of workers' comp costs, your workers' comp premiums are outrageous. You know, also your healthcare costs. I mean, healthcare costs in 2017 were somewhere around $350 billion in the United States. And people who regularly get chiropractic care take somewhere between 80 and 85% less pharmaceuticals.
Wow.
So even if you, you know, just on the simple end of it, so workers' comp, healthcare costs, premiums, you know, and then also too, if you're just a really cool business owner and you really want to be invested in the health and long-term happiness of your employees, it's really important.
And then if somebody wanted to learn more, have more substantive conversation, where can they find you?
www.workwellforlife.com, or you can send me a direct email at Cherie, C-H-E-R-I-E, at workwellforlife.com.
And the four is the number four.
Yes, that's correct.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Chris Tuff, the Millennial Whisperer. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Chris, did you learn anything? How's your back? Any lower back pain?
I feel like I'm getting judged on my posture over here.
Yeah,
I'm like,
a little bit.
I've got a straight back. Yeah, we're good to go, I think. How am I doing right now?
It can be better.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I do it.
You set yourself up for that.
I know. The stretching thing is not my strong point.
So tell us about the Millennial Whisperer. How'd that come about?
So I was actually on, you know, I kind of grew up in the social media, digital advertising side of the world, and I've always been surrounded by millennials most of my life, you know, in the working world, and I'm right on the cusp. So I'm 38. So just for, so people know, 37. Full disclosure,
authenticity,
I'm right on the cusp.
That's important, right?
Absolutely.
For millennials.
Exactly.
You got to be authentic.
Exactly. But we're talking about 37-year-olds to 23-year-olds. So, you know, I'm right on that cusp. And I think that's also what has kind of empowered me along the way to really embrace managing this generation. And fast forward, been at my ad agency where I'm a partner, 22 squared locally. We're about 270 in Atlanta. We're still privately owned. And then we're about 180 down in Tampa. But 90% of us are millennials. And so I was at an executive retreat.
What, was that on purpose or that just happened?
That just happened. And a lot of advertising, creative industries are similar. Mm-hmm. I was on a executive retreat with 14. I'd say the average age was 45-year-old men who I didn't really know. And I introduced myself, and my role there has changed and evolved. And, you know, it was about 2.5 years ago that I really took on this role of being the empowering leader, where I was less of the Don Draper, if you will, and where I was selling every day, to being more of the coach and leading from behind the scenes.
And what was the catalyst for that?
Me hitting rock bottom. And so, you know, I start the book with that. Where
so what
I hit
does rock bottom mean?
Rock bottom was my lowest of points to in my, you know, being an adult life. And I had lost sight of what was real to me and what was true. And that was my...
So what'd you think was real and true?
I thought I was beating my brothers at the game of life. That was my metric of success, which I do not recommend for anyone.
So you were competing with your brothers specifically just like brothers, like no, it was the general term? Of
no, my brothers, like my older brother, Jeff, and my older brother, Alex.
So it was very specific.
It was. And so one of the key things was... I was spending so much time on the road and getting burnt out and losing sight of my two daughters and wife that are the backbone of everything that I do and the foundation of what I'm trying to build. And
but they didn't bring you the joy that beating your brothers did?
So that's what flipped, right? So and I flipped that kind of success metric to beating my brothers to success will be judged on a daily basis when my head hits the pillow. Did I have the impact that I intended to for that day? And that was a huge change, as well as a few other pieces. But one of the biggest ones was putting all of my effort into trying to coach and empower others. And so it was right. It was about 7 months right after that change, as I was starting to really invest my time and energy into my group of 30 millennials within my kind of core offering, which was content and social media. And I introduced myself and I was like, I don't really know what I do anymore, but I'm kind of like the millennial whisperer. And we were all surrounded by the fire, and I go and everyone's like, interesting. And then I sit down, and the guy that was leading the retreat, Tommy Breedlove, who's also local, he kicks me. He goes, I didn't know Tommy at the time. He goes, you better write that book. And I was like, what book? He goes, The Millennial Whisperer. I was like, it's not a book. He's like, well, if you don't write it, I will. And then so that then started the conversation. These guys were like, so tell me about like, what are some of the things you do? And I was like, well, for example, I do this. They're like, you do that stuff? Are you kidding me? And then it was right around
then. So you were talking about like specific tactics?
Tactics, right? So, you know, one of the tactics is I say, well, anytime that I have team status, I start it with snaps, where I create this environment of empathy where instead of everyone going through an Excel document, we start it with snaps. So I'll start it off and I'll say, I want to give snaps to Meg because she went above and beyond because she pushed herself out of her comfort zone. She killed it with the presentation and it was one of the best I've ever seen. So we'll snaps. And then that creates this domino effect that usually 30 to 40 minutes of our hour in our status is people giving
it's
snaps
just
to one
appreciating
another.
Everybody.
And it's peer to, and it, and not only that, but you end up covering a lot of the things that you would naturally within some boring
as an
Excel.
Update because exactly. You're appreciating for whatever that action was they took.
Exactly. And that was when they look at me and they're like, what? And I looked around and I was like, okay, I think I got something here. And, you know, once again, we wrote it over about a 7 month period. We published in February. We've sold about 35,000 since then. I built out a separate consultancy around it. I was at a corporation to remain unnamed on Monday in front of 1,300 of their employees. And it's starting to, we'll be in every airport face out June 1st. So we're just now, I think, hitting this groundswell of buzz and, I think it's having the impact I intended.
And then what does the impact look like to you?
To me, it's changing the way that our organizations empower and look to incentivize our this next generation. And to me, it's really two main points. How do we bring more empathy and love and more connection into our lives? That's everything, whether it be with my daughters, whether it be with my wife, whether it be with my guy friends. How do we bring more empathy and more connection? And a lot of the tactics in this book are basically oriented around those two main points where, for example, I think one of these things, you look at what millennials are looking for statistically, right, from their leaders. Number one, it's inspirational leadership. Two, autonomy. Three, transparency. And, you know, within that, there's some other kind of nuances. But you look at some of those things, and transparency is one of those that I love interpreting because a lot of leaders think they either need to cry in front of their people or they have to show their profit margins. And it's neither one of those. It's just be real, right? Create a real connection with your employees. And so one of the contentious things or what I'm finding as I talk to lots of radio shows, a lot of them in Texas for some reason, and they say, wait, you encourage your people, in your book, you encourage people to follow their employees on social media. That's crazy. I was like, no. On Monday, when you come in, you can actually start a conversation and say, Meg, that concert you went to looked epic. Or Tyler, that dog is so cute. And it was funny. I was talking to another prominent leader who I can't name. And he said to me after reading my book, well, I don't want to post all my personal life on social media. Like, I just don't. I'm too private. I don't want to make that murky. I was like, that doesn't matter. They don't. Sure, that might create some sort of connection, but what they care about is that you follow them and actually strike up a real conversation. Show your employees that you are vested in their lives and that you care. So that's a lot of once you have that foundation, the rest will follow.
Now, a lot of the examples you've given thus far have been male leaders. Do you find it different that a female leader maybe deals with millennials differently?
I think it's more intuitive, I will say. And actually, if you break down my team, we're 90% female. And so
you're more female than millennial.
Within that, I mean, I think, absolutely. I mean, within my team, we are more female millennials.
So you're a female whisperer too? Is that
I would say that
the
actually
transitive property?
I'd say even in the parental archetype within my two daughters, I have a 7-year-old and 9-year-old, and I get really fired up about this in a passionate mm-hmm. way. But I'm actually much more of the female archetype in our household, where I wear my heart on my sleeve. I a lot of those things that and Sarah Blakely and I will have this conversation about female leaders versus masculine leaders. It's also some of the problems that I have with Tony Robbins and some of the things that he goes off and says, and it seems like he's in some hot water for some of the things with BuzzFeed. But I am deep down actually much more in line with that female archetype, which is also why this empathy and connection comes so naturally to me. And I think it's oftentimes misunderstood. And now, okay, but I want to make sure that people understand another aspect of what I'm bringing about in the book is this idea of what social media has done to us as humans, whether it be millennials, younger millennials, older millennials, or even, you know, boomers and Xers. We're all affected by what social media does to us. And one of the big, I think, outcomes of that is what I call my 70-30 rule, which is introducing to everyone, 30% of life sucks. 30% of your job is going to suck. 70% should fuel you up, fire you up, and get you, you know, motivated to come in the morning. But when we're coming down and actually looking at your job description, let's figure out what's in the 70% and what's in that 30%, because we've got to stop comparing our insides to other people's outsides. We all do it. I call it the Pinterest station of our generation, where it's just absolutely exhausting. Take the first day of school, for example. You see, you've got everyone, especially young parents. You've got Abigail's first day of first grade and her teacher's name and favorite food. It is exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting. And we get into this mindset that the grass is greener on the other side. And the reality is the grass is not greener on the other side. The reality is that life gets hard and that there is no perfect job. So how do we also take some of these massive influences of what makes this a different generation and actually apply it to us as humans to bring a little bit more of those reality checks?
So now, are there strategies in the book dealing with the millennial as the employee, but also some coaching on the millennial as the leader of leading other people?
Yeah.
Are those just kind of similar?
Absolutely. The book itself is mainly for Xers and boomers that are managing teams of millennials. I haven't really announced this yet, but the exciting part is that the next book, which I'm starting to work on this summer, is going to be directed to millennials and how to manage up or within their teams to boomers and Xers, and then how to manage down to Gen Z. One thing that I am very upfront about within the book, as I talk to very large corporations about implementing some of the ideas in this, you know, some have come back to me, especially the startups that are no longer startups and making billions of dollars. They're like, well, 90% of our managers are millennials. And I was like, so one of the key things I do in the book is, older millennials and younger millennials are two very different generations. I call them Oregon Trail millennials and Snapchat millennials, because the older ones, they had beepers in college and played Oregon Trail in high school. It's very different than the younger millennials that were given a Snapchat account on their iPhone at age 13. So that's what makes them very different, is the adoption of technology and what that does in social media to our brains and the social side of ourselves. But then also the other big reason why they're very different is 2008, the recession, how it affected us as individuals, older millennials. We were in the market or about to enter the marketplace. So we inherited a lot of this ability to be more resilient and entrepreneurial because of that. Or younger millennials, they saw their parents lose their job. So what they're looking for is they're looking for a place to actually hang their hat, to spend a little bit of time, to dig in, to they're not going to jump around as much. So older millennials and younger millennials are actually two very different generations because of those two things. And those are some of the concepts. And then I break it down into tactics of how do we manage these people differently.
Now, what are some of the stereotypes that you think are just kind of people not looking at the whole picture?
So I think I'll be asked, so what are the stereotypes are true and what are not? And so the ones that are untrue, I think, are a lot of the times. I think millennials, oftentimes it's used as a synonym for inexperienced or young. And the truth is that they're both inexperienced and young, right? So stop using millennials as just a synonym for that. Instead, you know, yeah, I did the cover of my book this way, but self-absorbed, spoiled, needy, you know, there are certain aspects that just are untrue. But then there are also certain aspects that are true. And so one thing that I do think is the needy piece. I say that as managers or as corporate leaders, if our head hits the pillow at the end of the day and we're not utterly exhausted from rewarding and recognizing our people, we haven't done it enough. And the reason why we are much needier this generation is needier is because...
But are they needier or just more vocal?
I think both of those things. I think both. They're not as scared to vocalize, but they're also not as scared to leave a job when they don't get it. And so, but... What makes it different is anytime they grew up in the era of helicopter parenting. So a lot of them did actually get participation trophies for everything they did.
And did they like it?
They expected it. They didn't just like, they expected the trophies along the way. But then the other side of it is anytime in their adult life they wanted it, they posted something to Instagram and they'd get the 120 hearts on their post to get that instant gratification and validation and reward, essentially. That if we're not doing that within our corporations, then they see that as a deficit and they'll just leave. And so it's an absolute requirement. And you know, one of those ideas that I bring up is snaps, right? Another one I talk about is this big blue rooster that they have out in San Francisco at a startup called Domo. And for the salesperson of the month, they'll bring this 10-foot blue rooster that sits next to their desk for that month whenever they end up winning that salesperson of the month. And people are clamoring for this big blue rooster. They also play your at-bat song, so everyone signs when you start there, your at-bat song. So it'll be like Christopher Tough, whatever, All I Do Is Win. And then they'll play that over the loudspeaker on the first day of the month. Sirens go off, and it's this big celebration. And it's funny, I talk to some leaders, and they're like, Chris, either like with startups, they're like, I'm giving away all my equity, you know, or I gave X amount of money. I'm like, stop. Like, you're doing the wrong thing. Don't throw money. Sure, that's important. And it's the number one thing that people are looking for is, you know, benefits and money. But you can get more creative. What's your big blue rooster? Or what are your snaps? What are some of the things that you can start creating to actually reward and recognize and build this environment of empathy?
And since you wrote the book, how has that impacted your work in your day job?
So,
or is this now your new day job?
So it's morphing into my new day job, and I will say it's a lot of talking to corporations and trying to coach them, and I miss the connection with my people. But I'll also say that my own success metric is I want to change the world, and I'm doing it through the lens of this book. And 2 weeks ago, I spoke, I hosted and spoke at an HR conference, basically the Fortune 100 heads of HR, and did my speech, and it went amazing. I did the math, and I said to myself at the end of the night, I was like, oh my goodness, I impacted over 10 million workers' lives through the lens of this speech, and the, and everyone got the book. Even if it's just a small step, that is a much larger impact. And so everything that I'm doing right now is around how do we continue to build this platform up and introduce the book to the corporations. I'm building out a pretty big digital course that will go live probably the end of August, so we can truly scale this thing.
So now, in the perfect scenario, the people have the book, they buy what you're selling,
sure.
they're in. Now, how does that change the world? All the millennials, I'm dealing with them in the way they want to be dealt with, and I'm inspiring them to be the best they can be.
Sure. I mean, the biggest thing, and it's my favorite quote from my friend Evan LaPointe, and he turned to me after reading the book. He goes, millennials aren't the problem. They just expose all the problems. So it's essentially, how do we change our corporations and use millennials as the catalyst to this change? Everything's changed.
To make them more human, more connectors, exactly. And making more impact?
Exactly. And purpose. You know, purpose is what outside of your bottom line and stock earnings or whatever it is, what do you represent? What is your true purpose? What is your why? And how are you going to actually make that evident in the things that you're doing every day? And, you know, especially as you look at the younger millennials and Gen Z, they will not work for companies unless you have that. So it's not, it's becoming a prerequisite for companies to start finding it. So, you know, I think it's both the why, but also within ourselves. And I find so many of my friends, I mean, as a lot of my friends tend to be going through midlife crises, and those crises are because I say life needs to be a ruthless pursuit of passions. And sure, it's not easy finding that way, but once you find it, that's where true impact happens. And that's where change happens. That's where I think the altruistic nature within ourselves really is unleashed. So I'm trying to unleash that within our corporations and scale it. That's how we're changing the world.
But the change happens for some people after they have some level of security financially,
yep.
That then they can open their mind to these other opportunities. When you're out there scraping and you're just grinding, trying to make it through the day or the week, you know, do you think that that's still like that's an aspiration, but is that practically possible?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely practically possible now more than ever before. I mean, look at the even just virtual being able to work virtually. I think, I mean, with technology like Zoom and other things, I mean, access is better than it's ever been. So I think that there are certainly things that get in our own way. And I have this rule with everyone that I work with. I call it your sitting in your car rule, where if 2 days in a row you're sitting in your car and you're dreading coming into work to go into your day-to-day job, and it's not associated to your own procrastination or your own self-development, meaning
but that takes self-awareness. So now an expectation is the person has self-awareness to
sure.
to take some ownership and personal yeah. accountability and responsibility for that feeling.
Exactly. And so if 2 days in a row you have that feeling, then let's talk about it because something needs to change. Either we need to open up a new way for you to work into another department within the agency, or we need to figure out and revisit what your own purpose for being here and what is driving you. And maybe we might have to open up something outside of the agency with some other corporations. Maybe nonprofit is the place you need to go. And I've actually had I've had employees move to Australia. I've had employees quit and work for a nonprofit, and I'll revisit them now. This is, you know, a couple of years later, and they're so much happier for it, and they're so much more fulfilled. And sometimes that's what it takes.
And then you, as a leader of an agency, you're okay with that because you want the best for that person, whether it's with you or without you.
And it took me a while to get there because I used to take offense when people would leave. I'd be like, oh, you're dead to me kind of thing, right? And I mean, because it is. You take it personally and it's like, what did I do wrong? It comes... So I've evolved in that viewpoint.
So how are you doing on the scoreboard with your brothers? That's what everybody wants to know.
So I will actually say, people will ask me, what's the hardest part about... What's been the most surprising thing from writing this book? And my oldest brother, he heads up innovation for Deloitte. His name's Jeff Tuff. He wrote a book called Detonate, coincidentally, 9 months before me. And I think it's almost
coincidentally?
Like... Coincidentally? Totally. Like, so I had... it took me... It took me about 14 months to write to actually publish the book from concept. And so it was coincidence. So it wasn't me trying to beat him or anything. But I will say that through the process of writing my book, he opened his arms to me. And it's almost anyone that's written a book and tried to get a bestseller. It's so hard in so many ways. And it created a newfound bond and relationship that I never had.
So while you were both, was there a period you were both writing at the same time?
No, we never overlapped. So I was right behind him.
So he didn't help or you didn't go
to
him?
No, he opened up the doors. He absolutely helped. He was like, Chris, I would do this. Don't do that. And at first I was like, wait, are you just like trying? And then at first
you were suspicious?
At first I was absolutely suspicious. I mean, here's the guy that is, we haven't always had, he's 10 years older than me and always kind of setting the bar with everyone around him, right? Graduated first of his class from Harvard, Dartmouth, blah, 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 right? And hasn't always taken that much interest in my life. And it's funny that this is coming out on Business Radio X right now. But it was the first time that he looked at me and he was like, wow, Chris, like you're doing it. And you're doing it pretty much on your own. I put it all on the line for this book. I got a $200,000 short-term 6.9% interest rate loan from SunTrust. And my banker's like, Chris, enough. Stop throwing money at this book. I'm like, I'm doing this thing. And so it was through that process that my brother and I actually created a newfound bond. And he opened up a lot of doors for me up in Boston where he is and gave me great tips along the way. And it's also with that that I promised to any one of my friends that if they're writing a book that I'll be that sounding board and I'll tell them where I made my mistakes and where I made some of the good decisions. But I'm really excited. We've sold about 35,000 books and we were a bestseller. We were like number two at Barnes & Noble for a little while. And I think we'll crescendo around August and then it'll be around that time. I'm actually going to be artist in residence down in Serenby and I'll be outlining my next book, which will be directed towards millennials.
And for you, when you're making that impact and those kind of aha light bulb moments are happening out there from the HR people where you're, you know, I guess they're the kind of the pathway to the employees at this point. Is that the most rewarding part of this or?
The most rewarding part has actually been some of the emails or Instagram messages or messages that I've gotten from people saying how either their boss has read the book and it's helped change their workplace or how they've used the book to have a massive result in terms of less turnover or almost real-time results for the things that we promise in terms of whatever that ROI is for your corporation. So it's really through those anecdotes coming back now that people are reading it that is probably the greatest impact.
And if somebody went to get a hold of the book?
So you find it at your local book retailer on Amazon or on my website. You can actually download the first chapter for free, and it's themillennialwhisperer.com. And having written a book with millennial in it like 9 million times, millennial is spelled with two L's and two N's. Millennial, two L's, two N's. So themillennialwhisperer.com. And I think, and then also June 1st, you can find it in your local bookstore at your airport,
at the airport.
With the face out.
That means it's a good one.
Hopefully.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And thank you for sharing your story.
Great.
All right, next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Catherine and Jay Wolf. Welcome.
Sorry, I'm a little hoarse, but
it's all right.
Doesn't matter.
All right. Well, Catherine and Jay.
Hey.
Tell us what you're up to. How are you serving folks?
Well, I had a massive stroke and nearly died at age 26 from a birth defect called an AVM that was in my brain and caused a massive brainstem stroke. I nearly died and was in hospitals and rehabs for over 2.5 years and subsequently have kind of come up for air after many years of not only tremendous recovery, including 11 surgeries, a broken leg, a subsequent but separate, totally separate brain aneurysm, to now we're over 11 years post-stroke, and I'm doing awesome. I've had another baby. And life has gone on in a very beautiful way. We've actually seen that through our tremendous, tremendous trials and struggles, there is this strange flourishing that can happen that is available to us all. In the midst of terrible struggle, there is a beauty. I should tell you that we're both 37, so we actually are
the millennials.
You're the millennials.
Same thing. Right on the edge.
Isn't that hilarious? So the double L, double N, I'm going to remember because I can't even spell the word.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, we got to get it, but we're technically living it, and yet we are most certainly the Oregon Trail version.
That was good to distinguish. Sure.
Times a thousand. We are most definitely not the Instagram when you're 12 or whatever. No.
And we're about to hire 3 millennials, so I'm like, "Where's I need my copy? I'm
going
to
get it today."
You'll have one, I promise.
Fantastic. I'm not kidding you. July 1st, we got 3 new ones coming, and we need this.
And about your stuff, too. I hope we don't need it just yet. But,
seriously. We're going to need some good wellness stuff.
I know that posture, too. I was like,
I've got everyone
back
on high alert now.
No, that's good.
So yeah.
Tell us about Hope Heals. How are you serving people through that organization?
So, do you want me to? Basically, I was in law school at Pepperdine. That was part of why we moved from the South, where we're both from, to California about 15 years ago. And at the end of law school is when our life changed course in this way. And Catherine had the stroke. And, fast forward a couple of years, it was a totally just different life than we ever imagined living. And in a way, all of us are faced with that prospect at some point. What do I do with this life I never imagined for myself? And do I eventually embrace it and find ways to leverage it and cherish it even, and hopefully for the greater good? Or do I fall victim to bitterness and trying to change things I can't change, really? And over much time and just community loving us and cheering us on, we leaned into it. And so shortly, probably a couple years after you got out of, the acute phase of surgeries and all that, we realized, gosh, we have this story that's really connecting with people. It's interesting, 2008 was when her stroke was. And so that was sort of the zenith of everybody's on Facebook, everybody and their grandmother, it's not just for college kids. And, we were sharing like prayer requests, updates or whatever on the Facebook page. And we were just seeing it disseminate across the world, like 120 countries, and just millions of hits on these sites. And it was pretty
crazy.
Breathtaking to be in a day and age where you were able to connect effortlessly with the world. And so that sort of has been a big part of our experience in taking the story of this thing that happened and leveraging it into something totally different.
We should add, I had a 6-month-old baby. We had
at
a 6-month-old baby.
Of the
before the stroke?
Before the stroke.
James is doing great and 11 years old now. And I think that really touched the world. Like, people went nuts wanting to reach out to us, wanting to pray for us, wanting to really support us in this. Because this young couple with this tiny baby is, she's likely going to die, was pretty much the reality we faced. In fact, they were going to let me die in the emergency room, but the renegade surgeon decided to try after seeing Jay and the baby in his arms. And it's like crazy dramatic, the stuff of movies, but it really happened. And I'm here today, which is probably the craziest part and why there's still interest in a book and a movie deal and a second book and blah, blah, blah. It's,
So now,
it's crazy.
Take me through the moment of, okay, so this terrible thing happens at the time, and everybody's freaking out, I'm sure. Family, you, everybody is just, I can't even imagine the pain and the fear that you're all, the vulnerability that you're all going through, and all those plans you had, and you're young, and all a future that you envision is now, it can be up in flames.
Yeah, totally.
How did you... kind of in your mind make that pivot as things started to improve, that you know what? I'm going to, you know, I guess stop being a lawyer. Are you still a lawyer? Are you,
yeah.
Or is now the focus on this Hope Heals? Mm-hmm. And now I'm just serving people and I'm trying to make, you know, mm-hmm. create the hope in the world. And,
mm-hmm. and time. Yes. Yeah. All well, that, all the things.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting. We, you know, again, we all have these view, this long-term view of our life as if that's going to make it manifest that way. And so, right. you know, we had this new baby, you know, right. new career. I was about to take the
but
bar,
everything was
that.
Happening just very the way you yeah. would plan it,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
There was no
right.
surprises
yeah.
in that. You
exactly.
were just going kind of paint by numbers life happening
yeah, yeah, yeah.
here.
Except
was,
the good surprises, you know,
right,
like the good stuff, like the baby's healthy.
Right,
and
you're checking
that,
boxes.
And
that's it.
Yeah.
Everybody,
so
everything's
we,
on plan.
Right. We, you know, basically... Again, we're at this crossroads where we had to
right.
decide what are we going to do with this. And I'll never forget one of Catherine's, like a distant relative who was blind, and she's an older lady, but she just, they remember they sat down really early on, like at Thanksgiving, and she just said, look, I remember early on thinking if I cry in bed all day and that would make me see again, then I'd do it, but it won't.
Right.
So I got to get up. Get out of bed and
so
go
there was
about
some of that
living
tough love, like,
my life.
Hey,
yeah,
you know,
just from a lot
okay,
of wisdom of people
bad,
who had
this
gone
is
through
not
hard
great.
Stuff.
Let's kind of
right.
take the next step. Let's move forward.
So I think,
and there were no other options. So it really was clarifying. We talk a lot about the value of tremendous constraint being this fascinating, clarifying, focusing element of our lives that when you've got no choices, you just go. And
right.
actually,
yeah.
it's quite beautiful in our day and age where we have so many choices,
sure.
like just pared down to learn to walk again or never walk again. You relearn to walk no matter how hard it is. And, you know, you do what you have to do and maybe... Maybe part of the millennial struggle is so many options, you know?
Sure.
Just saying.
Well, yeah, I think that's a powerful point, even with disability.
Yeah.
You know, there's a creativity that comes
right.
when you don't have every option in the world. There's
right.
there's a focus that
the
comes.
Constraint creates
yeah.
kind of the creativity.
This opportunity,
yes,
which is
yes.
very much the opposite of how we view constraints in our life. It feels
right.
like I can't have my dream. I can't have what I'm entitled
right,
to.
Right, yeah.
But really, it lets us focus. Flannery O'Connor, I love the quote that art, can only transcend mm-hmm. Its limitations by staying within them.
Yeah,
and I think
yeah,
that's so,
so
true
good.
For a life. And we've found that in our life to be true, not flourishing in spite of the constraints, but actually because of them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for us, I took the bar down the road. I kind of did some consulting while trying to also be a full-time caregiver and dad and, you know, going to hundreds of, you know, doctor's appointments and surgery prep and post-op and all these things just in that season of our life. And then hitting new obstacles. You think you go through hard stuff and you sort of check that off the bucket list and then you go to the vacation line items and that's not how life is.
Right.
It's like,
yeah, yeah.
you know, she continued to really face a lot of struggles we all have in our family system. And so the question just becomes, what are we going to do with this second chance life? You know, we're all living that, but
we're
right.
like, this
major
is the new normal.
Of it.
Right.
Yeah.
And at some point you accept that this is what life is, these are kind
yeah.
of the elements
yeah.
of this,
yeah, exactly.
this
and you,
life.
And you don't just accept it. I think you make the decision to not only embrace it, but to use it, to go with it, to champion
so
it.
So I'm going to make the best of this, and this is going to be the best life with
yeah.
these constraints.
We
right.
say there's no such thing as detours. That is
right.
The
obstacle is the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, that comes after, this has been 11 years. So this has been
yeah.
time to marinate. I mean, there's been a lot of loss, a lot of mourning, a
oh,
lot of
gosh.
Struggle,
right.
a lot of
yeah.
tears and pushing against. But
oh,
then it's just
sure.
been pretty powerful to say, now, if we lean into this, what would happen? And to see that there has been
so when you,
an
when
unleashing.
You, but when that kind of thought comes into your mind of, okay, I'm going to lean into this.
Yeah.
And you start leaning into this.
Mm-hmm.
When did you have kind of a sign or a signal that, hey, this is where we are. This is the right track to lean into this.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a million little stories. And most of the time, that's what it is rather than one sort of just aha,
one
pivotal
epiphany,
moment.
Right.
But I think, you know, in the digital age, too, having feedback from people all over the world has been profound. Because you can have your community saying, you know, we're here for you. And you're like, I get that. But does this matter in the bigger scheme of things in the world? Like, is this resonating? Is this mean something? And
right.
to just have people over the world struggling all different kinds of ways to say that hearing you get up out of the bed to this life you never saw coming has made me want to do the same.
Right.
And so we've, you know, you offer that to each other and then it gives people permission to share their stories and that continues to fuel this cycle.
And that's what I would say. That is what, to me, has fueled us so deeply in our calling. Mm-hmm. And this is recognizing that what we are saying and what we are living is deeply impacting the woman with MS in Nebraska, who will never know, but also my neighbor, the little girl in the wheelchair, and so many in between that when we come, and the businessman in Boston, and people who are not only inspired, but see us as doing it. And something about like seeing someone else doing it and stories of other people living out hard things makes you open your eyes differently to, I can too. This can be me, and I'm not afraid either. And that is like deeply fueling. Like, you're going to get up and go when you're like somebody, their why is just answered by how you live. That changes how you move forward.
So now the concept of hope heals. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you, and what do you want the listeners to take away from that, kind of the spirit of the message?
Yeah. Oh, hope heals is just our beautiful outpouring. It was kind of a revelation I had in the bathtub about 5 years after my stroke. So basically, and the listeners can't see me, I am in a wheelchair. My face is paralyzed on one side. As you can hear, my vocal cords are very messed up. One is paralyzed, and it's difficult to even articulate sound. And I have a hand that doesn't work, and I'm severely, severely disabled. I cannot drive. And yet, I felt a deep sense that I believe God was really calling me to use my specific tragedy, our specific tragedy, and the fact that he stayed, which is so unusual in our world and so beautiful, that our unique offering was to share how the hope that we have would be a part of what would heal us in this situation, because what was so much more broken and is still more broken, but not like unhealed brokenness, is the soul, is your heart. You're going, wait, this was my one shot at life, and now it's totally different. This can't be. I'm completely and totally on zero here. There's no hope. There's no way out. There's no answer. There's no change. And what flipped was, wait, oh, I can totally do this life. And I have everything I need to thrive in a world not made for me. And I think believing that there was something more for me than medical appointments and surgeries and endless, you know, fill in the blank, and seeing that my life could be one of thriving in the midst of constraint.
I think it's interesting, too, to your point, Chris, of, you know, there's this availability to the world to do some different entrepreneurial pursuits in this day and age more than really ever before. And so, I'm so sorry. And so we were able to form a nonprofit structure. That's what we felt led to create this structure, as to perpetuate sort of this story, and kind of leaned into it before we fully knew what it was. Even we started doing speaking and writing, you know, online. We started getting invitations to come to different kinds of places and share our story. And then that eventually prompted a book that we did with HarperCollins, Subset Zondervan. And again, that, you know, when you get a book out in the world, that sort of then takes on a life of its own. And several years fast forwarded, we began to see this disabled community that we were unwittingly a part of. You know, I think in some ways we thought, okay, Catherine will eventually get out of the wheelchair someday, and that won't, you know, that won't be our part of our story, our identity.
Yeah.
But then we realized, A, that's probably not going to happen. And B, again, what are we going to do with that? And you begin hearing stats like, according to the United Nations, people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the world, at about a billion people,
and
20%.
Which is crazy. Did you know that? Like, no. Largest minority group in the world? That's wild.
And the largest percentages of suicide, homelessness, divorce, unemployment are with people with disabilities. So you start hearing these things, and you realize it's not just an us versus them, but it's a we. Like, these are our people who we somehow have been thrust in the middle of this demographic that now we might be able to do something for and with and advocate for. And so, you know, because Catherine is a woman with disabilities, but also, you know, able to get around, able to articulate, and has won some, I mean, I'd say she's funnier after her stroke, actually, than before. Just some filter fell out, I think. And so we kind of, we've leaned into that and we've leveraged it. And we've, you know, how empowering is it to be a voice for a voiceless population? I mean, it's the great honor of our life. And we also began meeting people, again, families like us with disabilities, and most of them do not have the opportunities that we've had to be uplifted by a community and to find new purpose and to sort of be able to pivot. And so we realized there was this structure for families that really could provide some healing, that when you start healing the family system, then they go back to their communities, and those healed people begin to help heal other people. And it just creates this ripple effect. So the irony is that, like, you know, at this point with wheelchairs and stuff, we're probably more hotel people than camp people. But, you know, it was very clear, like, the structure would be great for camp. And those of us who've gone to camp know the power of just getting out of your normal rhythms into nature, you know, with other people, maybe who you don't even know, but who you share this common story and struggle with. And so we created Hope Heals Camp. Again, never saw that one coming, but we had created this sort of structure that allows us to do things that are out of the box that feel right. And we thought it did a lot of due diligence about it. But this will be this coming summer, our third iteration of Hope Heals Camp. And two back-to-back weeks, we rent a facility outside of Birmingham called Camp McDowell, and it'll be 800 people from 26 states and the UK.
It's crazy.
We kind of thought it would be this regional thing, and because we've leveraged social media and things like that, we have a very broad, I guess, network of people who are willing to come to Alabama in the summer, which is not usually where people summer,
it's,
you know,
so
in
weird.
Alabama.
Yeah.
Sort of the opposite place where people go in the summer.
The craziest, we've lived in California the past 14 years, and we thought there would be no way people from California would come to Alabama in the summer. No way. And they come in droves.
Yeah.
Like, people who can't walk, they had family members to carry them on airplanes to get to camp or drive across the country. It's insane.
It's not a lot like it around
it's
there.
It's very...
You know, there's a lot... There's, thankfully, things that are coming around individuals and a lot of times kids with special needs. Maybe they all come to camp or whatever. But, you know, people say, Catherine, oh, your story, your stroke. And it's like, well, this is our family story.
Yeah.
And our family has experienced a lot of struggle and pain. And our lives are forever different because of what happened to her. So we all need a community that will help in the healing process. And we've seen the power of that. So that's what camp's been. And it's been really just, it's transformed our lives to be a part of that rallying cry to say, this isn't the end of your story. There's more.
And then the message of it, your life is different, but it doesn't have to be worse. It could be better. And,
right.
And you can look at what you're going through as a gift, not a curse. You know, that's a choice, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Right. And I say chosen, not cursed. Chosen for this life. Yeah, I like it. You want to go on the road?
That's it. I'll be the warm-up act.
Awesome.
So yeah, we're just humbled. We've been in California 14 years. We kind of went there for adventure right after we married.
And you got it.
And we got a lot of adventure. It's not boring, as my father-in-law says. It's not boring.
Never been boring.
But then we moved back to Atlanta about 8 months ago to kind of be in a new season with our...
And we had a baby.
Closer to our family.
We had a new baby. We have a new little one.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. His name's John Nestor. Nestor's from my neurosurgeon. That's him alive. Really cool.
And then for people who want to learn more about the camp and all the other activities, what's the coordinates for you guys?
Okay, well, our main website is hopeheals.com. Our camp website is hopeheelscamp.org.
It's all on the Hope Heals site. And then
all through Hope Heals.
At Hope Heals is our handle on everything.
Yeah, socials are all Hope Heals.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine and Jay, for sharing your story today.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Sanjay Touré. Thank you to all our guests. And I guess the word of the day today is impact, because everybody in the room is making it. Thank you for listening. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.